It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the city that Chicago has become and whether it's the wave of the future for cities around the Midwest.
First, as we approach one of the biggest shopping days of the year, Black Friday, many parents are eager to find the latest and greatest toys to buy as Christmas gifts.
But according to our next guest, there are still toys on store shelves that are unsafe for kids. A new report lays out the most dangerous toys this holiday season and what you should stay away from.
Joining us now is Bruce Spate. He's the director of the Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group. We've got a link to his group's report, Trouble in Toyland, on the Central Time Facebook page. Bruce, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me on.
Well, the year 2013, at this point, we kind of assume that toys on store shelves are going to be safe, at least I do, but your report shows otherwise. So how widespread is the problem of unsafe toys?
Well, unfortunately, every year there are a number of toy-related injuries and even deaths that are reported to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So we have seen progress over the years, a reduction in the number of toys that's being recalled, and a reduction in the number of toy-related injuries, but they're still occurring. So we need to keep at it and not only make sure consumers and parents are aware of common hazards, but also fight for stronger standards to make sure that unsafe toys aren't ending up on the shelf.
Well, what are some of those common hazards that we should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, each year our report, Trouble in Toyland, looks at the data collected by the Consumer Product Safety Commission and, what are the hazards or the injuries, rather, that are being reported. And this year we highlighted four hazards that continue to really pose hazards to our littlest consumers. And those four hazards are choking hazards, toxics in toys, magnetic toys, and excessively noisy toys.
Okay, so the one I guess that stands out to me the most is the toxicity stuff. Now, I know that a while ago we were getting a lot of news stories about unsafe levels in products from China. That doesn't seem to be what's making headlines these days, but there still seems to be a lot of toxicity in toys that are out there. What sorts of things should we be aware of?
Yeah, well, this is a really important hazard to talk about, and it's one where we need strong standards in place because this is an invisible hazard. No parent or caregiver can look at a toy and know if it contains a toxic chemical. The most common toxic chemicals we're finding are lead, cadmium, antimony. These are all heavy metals that are toxic, but also phthalates, which are a PVC or used to soften PVC plastics. So we are finding a number of toys in the market still that contain those toxic chemicals, and really the solution here is to make sure that we put in place strong standards that never allow a toy with a toxic chemical like lead or phthalates to end up on the shelf.
Now, phthalates is, that's something that awareness is just cresting on in the last couple of years as people have become aware that it's an endocrine disruptor, among other things. But lead and cadmium, why are these showing up in toys at all?
Yeah, I know. It is shocking. And as you pointed out, back in 2008, there was a massive recall of toys primarily from China that had lead in the paint and the surface coatings. And, fortunately, we have seen far fewer recalls for toys that contain lead, but it still occurs. And we really have made progress. In fact, this year is the first year in eight where we've seen a really dramatic reduction in the number of recalls. But it still occurs, and we have to remain vigilant and make sure that we're holding manufacturers accountable and that we're testing toys before they get to the market to prevent exposure to toxic chemicals.
Can you give us the names of a few toys that we should avoid?
Sure. Well, we did highlight 30 different toys in our report this year. In terms of phthalates, there was a Ninja Turtles pencil case that had 150 times the legal limit for phthalates. And our concern with this toy is that some might argue it's a pencil case, it's not really a toy, and so it shouldn't be regulated as a toy. But, of course, products like this can easily end up in the mouth of a younger sibling. And so we really think that standard should be applied even to a pencil case. And after all, it is a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pencil case, so it would have appeal for young kids. But then we also found a Marvel Superheroes soft shield that had 2,900 parts per million lead, which is, the the legal limit for lead is 100 parts per million. So, you know, this is way beyond what's allowable. So, again, it's being vigilant and making sure that we're testing these toys before they get on the shelves and have the strong standards in place.
Now, we looked at some of the toxicity issues. You also look at choking hazards as well as noise hazards. So let's go to choking hazards. Now, these are toys which have little tiny pieces that can cause choking and sometimes death if we're not careful. What are you seeing out there in terms of choking hazards?
Yeah, well, this is a big concern. Every year, for many years now, choking has been the leading cause of toy-related injuries. And whether it's balloons or balls or a toy or even a part of a toy, which is what we most commonly find kind of accessories to toys that can easily, you know, come off the toy or are separate from the toy that end up being small and pose a choking hazard. So we continue to see a number of those products that are really too small and pose a choking hazard. The way the law is written, if a toy fits within a choke test cylinder that's 1.25 inches in diameter, if it fits in there, it can't be sold for a child under 3. If it's intended for children between the ages of 3 and 6, it has to have a choke hazard warning, which listeners might be familiar with. It's a standard warning that appears on toys. And we've actually advocated for two strengthenings of that standard. One is let's make it a bigger standard because children are choking on toys that are near small parts. So, you know, they're not fitting in that choke test cylinder, but they still pose a choking hazard. And any rounded object, there should be a stronger standard for as well, because we know that balls and rounded objects pose a particular choking hazard. So we not only need to do work to make sure we prevent the toys which shouldn't be out on the market and pose a choking hazard from getting out there in the first place, but we also need to strengthen the standard to better protect our littlest consumers.
So if parents want to strengthen that standard, want more testing, what is the best avenue to take?
Well, this is really action that needs to be taken by the Consumer Product Safety Commission and by Congress. Our toy safety standards are written by Congress, and in fact, in the wake of the recall that occurred back in 2008 around lead and paint, some of these standards were strengthened, but not the standards for small parts. So, you know, we really need to contact our members of Congress and the Consumer Product Safety Commission and urge them to strengthen these standards. And one other tip I'd offer regarding choking, we urge parents to actually use something they can easily find at home to test for choking hazards, and that's an empty toilet paper roll. It is a little larger than the choke test cylinder, and of course, it's easily accessible for parents. If a toy fits in that, you certainly shouldn't give it to a child under 3, but really should be watchful for any young child with a toy that fits in that empty toilet paper roll.
And what are a few toys on the market that don't pass muster?
Yeah, well, we did find a number of them. This year, there were a few Littlest Pet Shop toys, which, you know, are small little pets that children are buying that actually violated the choking standard. They weren't labeled with a choke hazard warning, and they were intended for children ages 4 and up. So, you know, really it's, and I should generally say, you know, our report is less about the specific toys that are listed and more about making sure that parents and consumers are thinking about these hazards when they're shopping for toys, keeping in mind that these are common hazards, things they should look out for, and really just to be vigilant and make sure they're not purchasing toys that might pose these hazards. I think at the end of the day, this is about using common sense and making sure that, you know, if a toy sounds too loud when you put it to your ear, you know, it's probably not going to be good for your child's ears. Or if it has small parts, you know, be watchful about that as well.
Right. And you mentioned noise and being too loud for our ears. And that's something that I think a lot of people wouldn't be that aware of, whether something's too loud. Kids' culture does seem to be loud these days. Why do we have to be worried about noisy toys?
Yeah, well, actually, noise is a big concern. The Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders estimates that 1 in 5 children has some hearing loss by the age of 12. We know that they're exposed to a lot of loud sounds, and certainly toys are one common source. We had 3 toys on our list this year, which exceeded the standard of 65 decibels for a toy 1 inch from the ear, and the standard of 85 decibels if a toy is measured 10 inches from the ear. So there are loud toys out there, and you know, it really is that, well, the best way to test is if it, again, and sounds loud to your ear, then it's probably inappropriate for your child. But another thing parents can do is tape over the speaker or just take the batteries out if a toy sounds too loud and you already have it.
All right. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Bruce Spaeth, the director of Wisberg, and we've got a link to the report Trouble in Toyland on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, a look at the city Chicago has become and what it means for our future.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the 1980s, author Thomas Gagin wrote that Chicago was the last great American city not yet ruined by yuppies. Today, our next guest says Chicago has become a city that, in fact, works for the rich, a place full of foodies with manicured parks and lots of hipsters around.
Meanwhile, the poor have been pushed out of gentrifying neighborhoods, and Chicago leads the nation in homicides. Thomas Frank from the Midwest himself sees this kind of disparity as the future for many gentrifying cities.
Thomas Frank is the founder and editor of The Baffler magazine. His most recent book is called Pity the Billionaire. He joins us now to discuss his column in December's issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Chicago is the Future. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
How are you today?
I'm good. And you?
Dandy.
All right. Well, you call Chicago of the 1980s an ugly city. What was it like? You lived there at the time.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I'm quoting someone saying that. I didn't think that at the time. I loved the place. But when I think back about what I liked about it, yeah, it was pretty ugly. It was, you know, it was this rotting, industrial town, sort of at the end of the industrial era. A lot of really, and Chicago still has a lot of really grand public buildings, but it was grandiosity back then. It was grandiosity of a different kind. You know, everything was enormous, vast, empty, crumbling, rusting. You know, litter strewn everywhere. That's what I remember. But the funny thing is, I really liked that.
And you say that it was a Chicago in transition. In fact, it hadn't even really transitioned from deindustrialization. And there was something that you really reveled in, that kind of Chicago that hadn't caught up yet.
Yeah, it was a real city. So I'm from Kansas City. And Kansas City, I imagine, was a real city once too. But over the decades, Kansas City has developed this really bad case of urban sprawl or suburban sprawl, I guess you'd say. You know, it has no mass transit to speak of, and it's this gigantic place with no urban core. And Chicago had all the things that cities were supposed to have. You didn't have to drive if you didn't want to. It had famously a tavern on every street corner. It had industry, it had manufacturing still. There were still steel mills in Chicago back in the 80s. It had all that stuff. And, of course, it had the suburbs too. And great university, lots of people doing experimental things in the arts, you know, often uncelebrated. And it was wonderful. I just was, I had a great time there.
You went back recently, and that's the core of your piece. What do you see as Chicago today? What has changed?
Well, so I moved away 10 years ago, and that was originally the impetus for writing this essay, is go back to Chicago after 10 years and see what it looks like, what's changed. And specifically, I lived in the South Side in a neighborhood called Hyde Park, which is where the University of Chicago is. And it's also where the President of the United States comes from. So, obviously a lot has changed there in the last – when I moved out of Chicago, he was our state senator, Barack Obama was. And, now I'm going back, and he's, of course, the president. And so the most obvious thing is the changes that are related to that. For example, the street that he lived on is completely blocked off by the Secret Service, and they won't let you drive through, and they won't let you walk through. You just can't get through, period. And that has in turn allowed for all sorts of gentrification in the neighborhood around it, And what was funny is that when I went back to Chicago, this was back in September, I guess, and it was when there were this really horrifying series of shootouts going on in the city, and the Chicago had won had the most murders of any city in America, the most homicides, and there was that going on. But when I walked around in these neighborhoods in what I call the green zone, what my friends there refer to as the green zone, like in Baghdad, it was so perfectly safe, and you wouldn't even know that these incredible shootouts were going on 20 blocks away or something. You wouldn't even know it. It was a different world.
Now, it sounds like you're describing this sort of upstairs-downstairs phenomenon that's happening in Chicago, but it also sounds like that gentrification rubbed you the wrong way a little bit in Chicago. It got a little overly precious. But when we talk about gentrification in a lot of cases, there's often less crime in that area, there's less urban blight. And is there something wrong with a gentrified Chicago as you see it?
The things that you mentioned are very true. For example, one of the best way to get crime out of a neighborhood is to make the rent really expensive. This is well known, and that has certainly happened. And so the sort of massive kind of gentrification that's gone on in a place like Chicago has made the sort of green zone phenomenon possible. And it's really nice to be in the zone, right? It's a much prettier city today than it was when I left. The food is better. We'll get to that in a minute, I imagine. There's lots of great things about it. On the other hand, the problem with gentrification obviously is that it prices a lot of people out, and people have to leave their neighborhoods. And it's also we're basically talking here about conspicuous display of wealth. We're talking about the kinds of barriers that money puts up in all sorts of different aspects of life, not just in rent, can you live in a neighborhood or can you not? We're talking about vast parts of a city being basically becoming kind of a country club for a certain class of people, and that's unfortunate.
And that seems like at the core of your concern here, that there are two Chicagos and maybe by extension two Americas side by side, a wealthy country club environment here, and everybody else in a fairly dangerous, high poverty, high crime zone.
Yeah,
are you worried this is going to expand to the rest of the country?
This is happening everywhere. It's particularly noticeable in Chicago because it's noticeable to me because I had been away for so long, and also because it's the president's hometown, and lastly because of the sort of really extreme nature of the folly, that has followed in the wake of the money, of the gentrification. But yes, this is happening all over the country. This is what inequality looks like. And in fact, I'm sure it's conceivably worse in other places that I'm not very familiar with. I'm sure you could write the same thing about New York City, only it'd be much, much more intense, or San Francisco or something like that. But those aren't my places.
Well, you look at that income inequality kind of through the lens of food in Chicago, where it seems like this is one place where food is the barometer. What is it about food in Chicago that sort of signals what's going on there?
Yes, that is exactly the case. This is what Chicago is famous for. So after I moved out of the city, I would sort of keep up to speed on what was going on there, reading the newspapers, and every time I read a story about what was happening in Chicago, it was always about the restaurants and the food scene. And this had never been an important part of life for me when I lived there. I mean, obviously, I ate food. Everybody does. But, going to restaurants was something that was sort of outside my price range. This is not what I did. I cooked at home. And yet, this is always what you hear about. So I wanted to look into it. This kind of intense gastronomy scene that's going on there, and sure enough, it is really extraordinary. Chicago produces has all these sort of world class chefs and these world class restaurants, and the food that they serve and the food that they're renowned for is always like taking some sort of esoteric ingredient and running it through this escalator of complications and preciousness, injecting it into a hollow sphere of ice, or turning it into a foam and then deep frying it or something like that, or doing something really outrageous to it. And this is sort of what the city is known for now. You did you see the stories a while ago when Charlie Trotter died? Like, what was that? Mm-hmm. A couple weeks ago, he was sort of the beginner of the initiator of this style of cuisine in America.
And Thomas, actually, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Man, I was just getting started.
We'll have to have you on again. That's Thomas Frank, founder and editor of The Baffler magazine. We've got a link to the article we've been talking about on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's Thanksgiving and the first night of Hanukkah. We'll talk about what Hanukkah means in America.
And we'll hear how more stores are staying open on Thanksgiving, hoping that consumers will begin their holiday shopping a day before Black Friday.
And then with the beginning of the holiday season, more people are thinking about helping others. We'll get some advice on giving in the holidays and beyond.
That's coming up on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, it's deer hunting season in Wisconsin, and we'll hear from a family of hunters. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Many Wisconsin families hunt for wild game. Carol Gunsberg grew up eating venison and wild birds, but she was ambivalent about hunting and embarrassed by her dad's enthusiasm for the sport. As an adult, she came to appreciate her roots. She shares her story in today's Wisconsin Life.
Searching for my brother's cottage in northern Wisconsin, my son and I drove down a dirt road, uncertain. Then we spotted a deer hide drying in the warm autumn sun, the buck's head still attached. Yep, this had to be the place. I cringed, laughed, and salivated. There'd be a venison feast in my future. I come from a family of hunters. I grew up tramping through the woods, learning to hold still and listen, to relish the sudden pfft of a pheasant flushed from a cornfield, to shoot a .22 rifle at cans on a fence rail. My dad hunted everything from rabbit to caribou. Once, he even took us Christmas tree hunting, blasting the top off a giant pine. Usually, he protected natural habitat. His appreciation of wild game extended to the table. Though I never joined in the killing, never even aimed at a live target, I obliged in the kitchen. At first, it was through eating. Venison, rabbit, pheasant, grouse, goose, and duck. When bird was on the menu, my siblings and I learned to chew cautiously, anticipating birdshot we'd spit into paper napkins. By my teens, I'd long since stopped shooting, and my ambivalence about the sport gave way to distaste because of its impact on my social life. I was marked as part of a hunting clan. One November night, late for a high school basketball game, I rushed into our dark garage and smacked into a deer carcass. At school, I fumed when I saw blood smeared on my ski jacket. My dad's hunting coveralls, draped on the blue spruce out front, embarrassed me. We were the Beverly Hillbillies without the wealth. I wanted to leave that sitcom behind. After college, I went to work for a Hudson Valley newspaper where I covered food. The Culinary Institute of America sent an invitation for a harvest feast. The main course? Venison medallion with chestnut puree. Whoa, I felt new respect for game, but I was far from my suppliers. 7 years and two moves later, I returned to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee, where I eventually resumed covering food. My dad's cooking repertoire had expanded, and we nudged each other to improve. He shared recipes for venison stir-fry and rabbit. I passed along my mother-in-law's instructions for venison stroganoff. Just as I'd begun to really appreciate hunting as a piece of my heritage, my husband, our boys, and I moved to Washington, D.C., the wild game supply line got interrupted again. On one of my last visits home while Dad was alive, I asked if he'd take me shooting. He practically leaped off the couch. As a reward for my interest, he sent me back east with a cooler of wild game, some of the last I've cooked. But on this golden afternoon in the North Woods, I found myself at a picnic table in my brother's yard, family all around, and venison steaks on our plates. It was a feast as good as any I remember.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org. This is Central Time. Saturday the 30th is Small Business Saturday, and this year the independent bookstore near you may have something different going on.
The challenges facing independent bookstores have been in the news the last several years, and last year even Borders, a mainstay on the national bookselling scene, went under.
This Saturday, writer Sherman Alexie is doing his part to help. Alexie is ushering in the first ever Indies First Day, where some 1,000-plus authors will hand-sell books in about 500 independent bookstores around the country.
Sherman Alexie joins us now. He's a poet, a writer, and filmmaker. Two of his most recent books include The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian and Blasphemy. He's the founder of Indies First Day. Sherman, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Well, tell us about Indies First. Where'd the idea come from?
Well, it came from an appearance, a missed appearance at a bookstore here in Seattle in the spring. It was a reopening of a store that had closed, and I had agreed to be there on opening day and then completely spaced it off. So to atone for that, Janice Segris, one of the co-owners, said, "What? You have to come all day." And I went there and spent hours there, and we realized I was being a bookseller. And I thought, author as bookseller, I think this could get bigger.
That's kind of radical. So I take it what you're doing is taking that idea, author as bookseller, and writing at large. This is what's happening across the country.
Yeah, and well, it points out the really special relationship between writers and independent bookstores, and especially between eccentric writers and eccentric bookstores. You know, my career is because of independent bookstores. You know, 20 years ago when I wrote my first books, you know, a book of poems and stories by a reservation Indian boy was not going to fit anybody's algorithm. I have a career because independent booksellers hand sold my book. They put my book in the hands of readers they thought would love it.
What does it exactly mean when you talk about hand selling? What does that translate to?
When a bookseller knows his or her customers, they know who they are, they know their tastes, they know what they love. And so they can find books they know they're probably going to love, but they can also find books they think are going to be new and challenging to them. And so I think that's really what happens for writers like I am, and writers like me, who be a surprise choice, a choice that is not going to fit or is going to be surprising, adding that human element to it.
Do you remember any stories from that first day on your Day of Atonement at your local indie bookstore when you were hand-selling? What surprised you about it?
What surprised me is how many books I could pull off the top of my head. I guess how good I was at it. I hadn't thought about it, but somebody would come in and say, "Well, I like this book. What other book should I read?" And then to be in the store looking and searching for the books they might love, books popped into my head immediately, and I was surprised by the speed of that.
There's been kind of a bibliotherapy movement going on lately. I don't know if you've heard about this, where people think that, you know, you can use books as therapy. And do you think that this is a way to do it? Like, you almost prescribe a book instead of letting the bestseller list do it?
You know, I think books have helped me in all sorts of amazing ways. So I imagine that you could find the book that would help somebody in a difficult time or to help mark a moment, yes.
You know, we hear a lot about the challenges of indie bookstores these days. Even Borders went down last year. Do you think this Indies First Day comes at kind of a crucial time for booksellers?
Well, actually, you know, independent booksellers have had a great year and a half, 2 years. And this year, in fact, I just learned that hardcover sales of actual books outpaced ebook sales.
What?
Yes.
Really?
Right now, there's a bit of a lull in ebook sales. Nobody's quite sure what that means.
Okay, so how do you feel about the ebook? You know, there's that debate that's been going on, this cultural conversation about whether there's something special or almost sacred about holding a paper book in your hand that you can smell and feel versus the ebook. Where do you come down on that?
Well, for me, the aesthetics are one thing. I mean, I just love the physical nature of a book and the interpersonal relationships inside a bookstore. But the big thing for me is that the ebook world is dominated by one company, Amazon. It has a near monopoly, and that's dangerous not only for authors and bookstores, it's dangerous for the world of ideas when one company can be in charge of who gets what.
So you're not against the ebook, you just don't want one person holding all the keys.
I'm against the libertarian monopoly of Amazon.
What do you think? You mentioned independent bookstores are doing pretty well, thank you, the last year and a half. What are they doing, you know, to compete then?
Well, you know, they're diversifying, I think, a little bit in terms of what they're offering. I think they've got more, they're selling more than books. They're bringing in coffee shops and restaurants. And actually, I think there's something more philosophical going on, something a little more interpersonal. I think in this digital age, I think people are longing for connection. And I think that's happening across the board, that people are turning more and more back toward old-fashioned means of commerce.
And that's what's going to happen on Indy's first day. Now, you've got, what is it, like 500 bookstores across the country doing this, 1,000-plus authors. How do people respond when you first hung your hat out there?
Some big names, too. James Patterson, Dave Barry, Lily Tuck, Cheryl Strayed, you know, some T.C. Boyle. A lot of mystery writers, a lot of kids' book writers. It's going to be astonishing. Some stores have 15 writers. So,
wow.
You know, there's going to be some circuses out there, and then there's going to be some really quiet moments, too, where one writer is going to be in a store for all day, which I think is going to be really special for that writer, and I'm kind of jealous of that.
I've been tracking this idea for a while, and I've been curious about how it would work, actually, because when I think about the stereotypical writer, and maybe there's my problem right there, but I think about someone who's probably an introvert, somebody who likes, you know, sitting down with their computer or their notepad and not being in the public eye. Do you think it's going to be weird for some writers to be in there, you know, selling books?
I'm guessing the introverts did not volunteer.
Yeah. And you're not one of these.
Well, you know... I take those tests, those personality tests, and I actually come off as an introvert and extrovert at the same time.
Do you think that authors do need to get in there, even if they're introverted, and join the battle to help fight for books and booksellers?
That's the thing. You know, we're competing against so much now, so many images, so many ways of getting books, so many other means of art and commerce that you really have to get out there. And tell your stories in person and be dynamic. You know, we writers all along, you know, long before this digital explosion, were also salespeople. I mean, I spend a lot of time on the road. I'm Willie Loman half my career.
Well, we're talking right now to Sherman Alexie, poet, writer, and filmmaker. His most recent book is called Blasphemy, and he's here to talk with us about Indy's First Day. It's an inaugural Indy's First Day coming up November 30th, Small Business Saturday, where authors around the country will be hand-selling books in independent bookstores.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite independent bookstore? Do you have a relationship with your bookseller that Sherman Alexie was talking about? Is it important to know your dealer when it comes to books? And where do you fall on the ebook versus physical book debate? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now we're talking to Sherman Alexie. He's a poet, a filmmaker, and the author of lots of books, including Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven, and Blasphemy. And Sherman's here with us to talk about the launch of Indy's First Day, where authors hand sell books at independent bookstores across the country. It was his baby, his brainchild.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have a favorite independent bookstore near you?
And let's go to the phones right now. We've got Dexter with us in Chippewa Falls. Hey, Dexter.
Hey, great topic. Thank you so much for covering the issue of independent bookstores. I've got two questions. First is very simple. Where can we find out more information about which independent bookstores in our area are taking part in this event and maybe which authors are going to be there? And then the second question, just about independent bookstores as a whole, how do they differ business-wise and how do we know what really is an independent bookstore these days? In my neck of the woods, we have Barnes & Noble, and I feel bad to admit that really is the only bookstore that I know of.
All right, couple good questions. Sherman.
Well, if you go to the IndieBound website, just look up IndieBound. It's bookweb.org. If you go on there, you'll be able to go in there, and then you can put in your zip code, and then it'll point out the stores that are in your area. And then if you also put in the search engine Indies First, you can go to a map that'll show you every store that's participating and every author that's going to be at those stores. So that's IndieBound is the American Booksellers Association's website.
IndieBound. Okay, what about how do you know what an independent bookstore is?
Pretty much, there's Barnes & Noble, and then there's everybody else.
That's what it is these days, right?
Yeah, if it's not a Barnes & Noble, it's an independent bookstore.
And is there, and you're calling it indies first, you're not calling it only indies. You're not telling people not to buy books at Barnes & Noble, right?
No, of course not. You know, we all have many retailers that we participate in, but this is a special focus on this particular kind of store. You know, these independent bookstores are cultural centers for their communities often. You know, it's not just about books. It's about the world of ideas. It's about kids' books. It's about story time. It's about bringing in authors and intellectuals and political thinkers. So, you know, these are community centers as well as being independent bookstores.
And let's go next to Kathleen joining us in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
My comment was about e-books versus books, whatever. And I get a lot more reading done if I can use a variety of ways to read. I spend a lot of time in the car, so I do books on CD. I watch my grandson's hockey practice, and I use the playaways because I can listen and I can watch what's going on. And I like e-books for when I travel because I don't have to pack a suitcase full of books or a car full of books. But I still like to curl up with a good old, you know, regular book.
So options. The options are working for Kathleen. Do you think
Kathleen is every writer's favorite kind of reader? The thing to remember too is that through Kobo, you can buy ebooks from independent bookstores as well. You can also do that if you go onto the American Bookseller Association website, the Book Web. You will see how you can purchase ebooks from your local independent bookseller as well.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Kathleen. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Are you attached to your local indie bookseller? And do you like the idea of having an author there, you know, giving you a specially selected book just for you? 1-800-642-1234. And we go next to Caleb in Richland Center. Hey, Caleb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
My question is, what do you think that the effect of audiobooks is going to have on reading or with physical books or reading in general?
Well, audiobooks have been around for a long time, and you know, I don't know the numbers, but I think they stay pretty consistent in terms of how many people are listening to books. So I don't think that has a large part in changing the nature of physical books or ebooks. There are some amazing audiobooks out there. I'm really excited. They just have a new one of Tim O'Brien, who writes about the Vietnam War, a book of short stories called The Things They Carried, that's read by Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad fame.
Wow.
Who played Walt. I can't even imagine how good that is.
So lots of, again, we're back to the options again there. And thank you for that call. And you were mentioning about the personal nature of independent bookstores. It made me think of Ann Patchett. I think I'm right. She opened an independent bookstore in her hometown. Do you think that's something, you know, more authors need to do is share that passion and make it personal?
You know, it would be great for authors to have very specific personal relationships with bookstores. And, you know, that's an idea that I'm actually thinking about in terms of promoting the idea of writers sort of being auxiliary members of a bookstore, not necessarily the owners themselves. Although, gosh, if you sell enough books like Anne and you want to, you know, open a bookstore, I think that's awesome, too. And they have a great bookstore there in Nashville.
So maybe you're thinking of a model where an author kind of is an attaché, a mentor to a bookstore.
An affiliate. There's
affiliate, something like
the
that.
The author affiliate.
And yeah, you know, one thing I'm curious about what you think, you know, is about the worry over shrinking attention spans. We've seen these articles, at least I've seen a few of them in magazines, about people worrying that in our digital age, we are developing these teeny tiny attention spans and we don't have it in us to sit down and read a really long, dense novel with lots of plot lines and characters and all of the work that comes with really deep reading. Do you see that as something you're worried about?
You know, I don't know. You know, I just saw another study that showed that kids actually prefer paper books over electronics. They still do. And you know, last year, 14% of e-books only accounted for 14% of total book sales. I mean, it feels like it would be much higher, and it may get higher, but the thing that remains is that people who love to read still love the actual books. they're still reading books, and I think that's incredible.
So we're not anywhere near close to a post-book era.
I don't think, you know, people keep talking about it. Some people seem to welcome the idea, but, you know, I don't think the change is happening as fast as people thought it was going to, and I don't think it's going to be as extensive as people thought it was going to be.
Do you find it harder to sit down and think and read deeply now that we've got computers everywhere? I mean, I assume that you're like everybody else, like me, that you do spend time online and you're clicking around.
And I get stupid. Yeah, you go into those rabbit holes of from link to link to link.
And an hour later, you emerge and you've done nothing.
Yeah, so you end up, as a writer, you end up having to combat yourself. You know, I've got applications that shut down my internet for specified amounts of time. So I can't go online. And then I often travel without my technology. If I want to go write, I'll just take a notebook and a pen and head off to a coffee shop.
All right, let's get another call in. Tom joins us next in La Crosse. Hey, Tom.
Hi. You know, there's a local bookstore here. You sell used books and all, and I've gone down there numerous times, and we'll trade back and forth. I'll take a bunch of my old books down, and he'll give me a new volume, or he's bought back several of the ones at reduced rates so he can resell them and keep the business going. And I think it, to some extent, it's like a library, but it allows me to keep the book as long as I want. And I think it's the local bookstores and are a good place to find someone who understands your reading habits. And also, I would say I like books because I find computer pages actually, to be diplomatic, boring compared to the page of a book from a design and architectural standpoint. The feel, as they say, of a true book.
Yeah, great comment. Thank you, Tom. What do you think, Sherman?
Oh, I love used bookstores. You know, one of the great things about living in Seattle, there's about 22 bookstores within about a 10-minute drive of me, and, you know, more than half of those are used bookstores. We have a bookstore here that's open 24 hours on the weekends, a used bookstore. You can go in there and, you know, be looking for John Grisham or poetry or you know, obscure science novels and nonfiction, and there's, you know, 8 or 9 cats roaming around the store, too. It's incredible. You know, that's something you're not going to find in a Barnes & Noble. You're not going to find online.
That's for sure.
You know, cat tracks above your head in a bookstore.
There are no cats.
Yeah.
Okay, Sherman, in our last 30 seconds, can you hand sell us a book that you would recommend to whet our appetites?
The book I'm really into is called Shout Her Lovely Name by Natalie Serber. It's a book of stories about women in the 21st century struggling through marriages. It's funny, it's intense, it's passionate, and it's a really wonderful set of stories.
And what is it called one more time?
Shout Her Lovely Name.
Shout Her Lovely Name. All right, Sherman Alexie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Sherman Alexie, a poet, writer, and filmmaker. His most recent book is called Blasphemy. He's the founder of Indie's First Day, coming up on November 30th on Small Business Saturday.
Coming up, we'll hear about Pope Francis's recent exhortation about religion, Jesus, and a lot of other things like politics, the trickle-down economy, and changing the church's leadership style. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.